Hello and welcome to the CRV Podcast. My name is Jeff Wright. I'm one of the regular contributors to the CRV website. On this episode, I am joined by Samuel Say of slowtowrite.com. Not only is Samuel one of the clearest thinkers and writers in the Reformed evangelical world, he's also one of the nicest people on the internet. I'm confident you're going to enjoy our conversation about his life and writing and much more. All right, let's get going on my interview with Samuel Say. Samuel Say, thank you so much for being on the podcast. We are delighted to have you here and cannot wait to talk to you. Before we get started, though, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Yeah, we're in the fall season here. It's getting a bit colder here in Toronto, and I actually love the cold. I'm African, but I'm a bit of a strange African. I love the cold. I love the fall. I love winter. So to me, I'm kind of pretty excited about, this season.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I have to confess, brother, I'm the complete opposite. I live in a state that has all four seasons, and it's really pretty here right now because the trees are, the leaves are changing and whatnot. But I so want to get to a beach this time of year and just stay till spring.
I guess for me, it's because Ghana is just, we have different seasons, but really all the different seasons are just hot, right? So yeah. I think when I moved to Canada at first, it was in December, like right in a very bitter cold in Montreal, which is a very cold area. Although all of Canada is cold, but particularly Montreal is pretty cold. And I think just fell in love with it because it was so radically different from what I was used to that it just, it's just like the challenge of being in a completely different environment. I think now it's just kind of stuck where I associate, the cold weather with, how different it is from what I was accustomed to for the first little part of my life.
Yeah. Well, that makes all the sense in the world to me. I don't know, constitutionally, for some reason, I can't stand the cold.
No worries.
Well, so you've raised some of this. I'm guessing most of our listeners are familiar with your work, sort of familiar with your story. But just in case not, so that we're all on the same page, could you kind of sketch out for us your background, where you grew up, how you were saved, and how you found yourself called into a writing vocation?
Yeah. As I said before, I was born and raised in Ghana until 10 years old when I moved with my family to Montreal, Canada. And then a few years after that, we moved to Toronto, Canada. That's where, by the grace of God, I became a Christian when I was 19. It was a prosperity gospel church, actually, at the time. Yeah, that's the environment I was raised in. And it's crazy because I always tell people that I was saved by the preaching of a prosperity gospel preacher. God can save people through anyone, anyhow, anywhere. And I was saved at a young adults retreat at a prosperity gospel church when they didn't preach. It wasn't a great gospel message. It was a lot of it involved heresy. Nevertheless, this is a pastor, female pastor. She said, "Christ died for sinners." And that was enough for my sinful soul. I had heard it many times. The gospel, I heard it many times growing up. I can count on one hand how many church services I missed throughout my life until I was 19. I was a godless person. I was an evil boy, an evil man when I was 19. But my mom, while she has some bad theology, very bad theology, she's reforming now, but she had a very bad theology, but yet she was a genuinely saved soul in a very bad church. And she would not let me miss church on Sundays. And so I heard the gospel many times. Even in that bad environment, occasionally they would say some good things. And but yet my soul, I knew I was a sinner. Since I was 5 years old, I knew that if I died, I was dying without Christ. And I feared judgment all my life because I knew how sinful I was. But yet knowing the state of your soul, knowing your sinfulness, knowing that you stand condemned, that by itself does not save you, right? It takes the regenerating work of Christ. And that didn't happen until just that one day, that one summer in 06 August, that all of a sudden what I had heard before just clicked. And so it didn't take me hard to become a Calvinist because I knew it had nothing to do other than just the grace and mercy of God. So anyways, I became a Christian at 19. And then at 21, I leave my church because I discovered through that time, John MacArthur, Paul Washer, Charles Spurgeon, and all these guys who were preaching the gospel. And they were preaching what I was reading in my Bible, but things that I was not hearing from the pulpit. So I leave the church. And then long story short, several years later, that's when Black Lives Matter is, you know, emerging and becoming just all my friends have fallen completely for this. And I was pretty shocked by how quickly so many people embraced Black Lives Matter, including many Christians. And I was quite confused as to it. I thought to myself, wait a minute, I don't agree with Black Lives Matter. Like, is there something wrong with me? So I was doing all my research and studying just for myself. And the more I studied, the more I became convinced that I was right. And the whole world seemed to be falling for this Marxist, postmodern evil movement. You know, obviously the word itself, Black Lives Matter, we agree with that, right? All mm-hmm. lives matter. All men, all women, all created beings, all particularly, of course, I should say, all created, all humans, all humanity are made in the image of God.
Absolutely. And that's the way I think that's the best way to sort of emphasize the dignity that men and women carry, right? All image bearers matter.
Exactly. I oftentimes say that I refuse to say the word, to say the phrase, even though I would generally, of course, agree with the phrase. But I know that the phrase means much more than what people think it means. I always say that the word of God has better words to affirm the value of any life, including Black people's lives, than a Marxist postmodern evil organization, what they could say. The Bible's words are better than theirs. Nevertheless, as my friends were embracing this, I thought to myself, you know what? The best way I could influence them was just to start a blog. And that's where I created my blog, slowtowrite.com, where it's named Slow to Write because I, from what I could see, so many people were rushing to judgments, rushing to condemn police officers and rushing to justify Michael Brown and other Black men who were in the wrong and who were, you know, doing criminal activity. And, you know, and then through that, cops feeling the need and being justified in killing them in self-defense. Nevertheless, I thought to myself that writing articles would be a best way for me to articulate myself. And that was in 2015, 5 years ago. And since then, the blog has been growing since. And I'm very, very, very grateful for that. But along the way, I've also been doing pro-life work because the more I wrote about Black Lives Matter, the more I realized, the more I became convicted that, you know, the biggest issue facing Black people is abortion. And yet Black Lives Movement is producing more support and more apathy on abortion. And, you know, in America, there are 300,000 Black babies being murdered in the womb every year. 300,000. You know, this year you had so many riots and so many protests, and the whole world has completely fell for this idea, this perception that Black people are being murdered by cops. Well, that's not true. But even if it was true, again, it's not true, but even if it was true, last year, cops killed 10 Black people that whole year. That's 10 Black people. Last year, they killed three, not they, as in the abortion industry, they killed 300,000 Black babies. Over the last 50 years since Roe v. Wade was passed, there have been 20 million Black babies murdered. We talk about slavery today as we should, right? We shouldn't forget our past. Nevertheless, there were roughly 500,000 to maybe 2 million Black Africans that were forced from Africa to America. That's horrible.
You're here.
Right? But that's 500,000 to maybe 2 million compared to 20 million who were not just oppressed as slaves, who did not have liberty, right? If you were a slave, you didn't have liberty, but at least you had the right to life, right? Now, of course, again, not having liberty is wrong. Nevertheless, at least you have the right to life. Pre-born Black babies do not have liberty nor life. They do not have the right to liberty or the right to life. So how we're so apathetic about that really disturbed me. And that's how I joined the pro-life movement. That's how I joined an organization named CCBR, which is short for the Canadian Center for Bioethical Reform. And my role there is to work with pastors and other religious groups to get them more involved in the pro-life movement so we can save babies here in our country, in Canada. Canada is even more radical on the abortion issue than America is. So we have all our work cut out for us here too. But so that's me. Hopefully, I've covered everything.
That's really helpful. And I appreciate that. Just having you walk through those numbers, it's just staggering. You just feel the moral weight of the choices our societies are making. I mean, if you're a Christian, evangelical Christian, reformed Christian who cares about the right to life, you know it's an atrocity. You know it is. But every time you run up against the numbers, it's too awful to really countenance that it actually exists in the real world, you know?
Yeah. It's very easy to those numbers, you see them and it's staggering. But even then, sometimes one of the things we do, and you may have seen it on social media, one of the things we do is we go to major areas and major schools in Toronto, and we show people what really happens to preborn babies when they're murdered. And the signs are horrific. Like, we have signs and we show them. It's horrific to look at. But when people look at those, when you see that, it's very, very difficult to just ignore it. And if you're a Christian, it should be difficult to see that and then to think that the biggest issue facing the world today, or facing Black people today, isn't abortion, which is killing, again, 300,000 Black Americans every year, but that it's what cops, what we think, or what some think cops are doing to Black people 10 times a year.
Yeah. Come, Lord Jesus.
Indeed.
Well, so, brother, I know, and I so appreciate you kind of walking us through your work and your writing. I've read on your blog that in some ways that I'm not entirely clear on, you attribute kind of your blog in some ways to Tim Challies or Challies.com. And if I'm correct, y'all go to church together, and Paul Martin is the senior pastor. If I'm right on that, could you elaborate on how Challies.com kind of helped aid you as you're seeking to serve your friends and speak to these issues that you felt a burden before the Lord to speak to?
Yeah. Yeah, so Tim Challies is one of my pastors, he's been incredibly kind to me. My blog wouldn't exist if it wasn't for him. And some might not be happy to hear that. They might blame him for that because I cause trouble sometimes. But but no, yeah, he's been so good to me. Not only because he is the most popular probably the most popular blogger there is, but he's also easily the most popular Christian blogger in Canada. And he's so influential to so many bloggers, especially to bloggers in Canada. So even just from that aspect, reading him from afar for so long before I became a member at his church, he's been a huge blessing to me in shaping just, how I think about righteousness and godliness and everything else. But when I came to the church, he was so helpful by taking me along and mentoring me. And, he one summer, actually, I was his intern working at his on his blog. And that was so helpful for me. Oh, man, that gave me, that was in 2013, I think, 2 years before I created my blog. And it's not a coincidence that it was those two things are so closely together, because that really gave me a burning passion to write as well. But even more than that, he had a writing class for people in our church, and that really helped me to develop a hopefully better writing and a more consistent desire to write and a greater commitment to write. He gave me books to read to improve my writing, to improve my how I think about writing. He's helped edit a lot of my work. He's on so many levels, he's been so crucial, asking me challenging questions, rebuking me, disciplining me, everything else that he could possibly do to love my soul. He's been doing it for me. He's a great man, and everything he writes on his blog is fantastic. But even in person, he's even a better man than you can imagine. He's been so good to me. And if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be dating my girlfriend, whom I'm planning to marry very soon. Tim shared one of my articles on his blog a few years ago, and that's how my girlfriend discovered me. And Tim's blog that day, she discovered my article, and then she started following me. Then we became friends, and we became more than friends. So I owe a lot of all the things that are dear to me to Tim Challies. So that's how he's had a huge influence on my life and on my blog.
Yeah. Well, hey, congratulations too on this serious relationship that's going to become a covenant marriage. That's wonderful. It does sound like Tim's been helpful to you in a number of ways. That's a good deal.
Yeah. Yes, he has. Yes, he has. And thank you for that. I'm in Canada, she's in America, and I would have loved to marry her a long time ago, but it's been just the getting the international kind of aspect figured out and visa issue. And COVID has not been very helpful to that this year and everything. So I would have married her much longer ago. But nevertheless, I'm excited about God's grace in our lives. And she's an incredible woman as well. She's been so helpful on my blog as well. But I'm doing quite a lot, at least by my own standards. Tim Challies is one of the hardest working people I know, if not the hardest working person I know. And I don't know how he does it, but I'm just, taking on some more responsibilities right now with my blog and social media and things like that. And I can barely keep up sometimes, but my girlfriend has been so helpful in that. I'm very grateful. I have a lot of people who've been very good to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that story too. So praise the Lord for good mentors, good pastors, and good women in our lives. Right. Well, your writing is something I really did, not surprisingly, want to talk to you about. As one of your readers, if somebody says, hey, what am I going to get when I go read Samuel Say? The things that come to my mind immediately are real gospel clarity, doctrinal faithfulness, and also just I get this sense that one of the unifying themes in your writing is you asking the question, what does Christian faithfulness look like if it's in response to some issue or it's in a certain context? We're both Baptists. I'm interested in Baptist history. Your writing makes me think of Benjamin Keach because he was kind of famous for saying, I want to live in a forthright fashion. I want to do what my conscience demands and live with a clear conscience. And I kind of get that same spirit when I read your writing. I'm curious, though, what do you see as the particular kind of unifying theme in your writing? And could you also just walk us through, hey, this is how I sit down to write. This is my process. If there is one or if it's spontaneous, I'd love to hear that, too.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm loving these questions. You're making me think. I love that. So one of the things. So I am not I've not gone to seminary. I don't have any kind of formal training in theology or anything like that. I'm just a lay person, just studying what I know. And I love talking to people, just my friends. That's how, as I said before, I created my blog just to write for my friends. And that's how I've kind of always seen it as. I just want to help other people see things the way I see it. And I'm a simple guy. I love reading highly intellectual people, but when I do that, then I want to try to think about it through, okay, what are they saying in simple terms? And I guess, because I'm not very intelligent myself, so I need to just kind of rewrite things in my head that way. And then I figure that since there are a lot of people like me, I want to communicate that same style to them. But concerning forthrightness, that's something that I really came to appreciate because of where I found myself in when I became a Christian in a prosperity gospel world, or particularly church. Because it took me about a year to recognize that I was learning heresy from my local church. And it was because of ministries of very forthright people like We Are the Master, John MacArthur, Charles Spurgeon, Paul Washer, the Puritans, like just very forthright. Because then they didn't mince words about what the prosperity gospel world was. There were other ministries that had done that, and it wasn't very helpful for me at all. Because if you lack clarity then you're not going, because then you're always going to give me some kind of a way out to think that, oh, the church that I'm in, that will make it very hard for me to leave the church. Because it's not hard to leave a church that I grew up in. It's not easy to leave a church that I grew up in. To leave a church that my mother has been taking me to since I was young.
Sure.
Where all my friends are. It will take some very forthright, straight to the point words to get me to say, I have to leave everything I hold dear to go to a place that I know. So I needed those kind of words. I needed some very forthright teachings from, you know, guys like John MacArthur and Paul Washer and other people. And since that was so helpful for me, I figure the same must be true for other people. So I'm an average guy. I like being forthright. So I figure that a lot of average people want the same. You know, sometimes we're so afraid of being candid or being forthright because we don't want to be offensive. And of course, I don't want to be offensive. No one should want to be offensive. Nevertheless, truth, biblical truth, the gospel is offensive to people. It is. So if the gospel, if Christ himself was offensive, not because he wanted to be, not because he was a rude person, of course he wasn't, right? He was the most kind man to ever live. Nevertheless, kindness also means being honest with people. So that's what I want to be. I want to be honest with people. Concerning how I consider my writing process, oftentimes, as I'm reading the Bible, as I'm watching something, just listening to things, I've always been an overthinker, and that caused me. My mom always tells me that I was one of the most annoying kids. She says it in a very kind way, but I was one of the most annoying kids growing up because I always had questions, always wanted to understand things. I wanted to know how things work. She always tells me that when I was young, about 2 years old, I essentially stole her precious watch, gold watch, and I destroyed it. And then when she came to me and asked me, well, why are you doing this? In a very angry manner, of course. I said, well, I wanted to figure out how it worked. And she says that because she says that she's always known that I like to investigate things, figure things out, try to ask questions so I can get answers. So that overthinking, that inquisitive, I guess, investigating aspect about me has led to me always just wanting to ask myself questions and figure out what my answers are to that. And that's how I develop a lot of my articles. It's just me asking myself a question and then figuring that if I'm asking these questions, others are asking the same questions too. And then when I come up with them, if I think they're interesting and or helpful enough, I write them down on a document, and I have I kind of chuckle as I say it because I used to think that I could never have enough ideas for blogging in a very consistent manner. But I have probably 150 to 200 ideas or questions I've asked myself over the years that I've been kind of keeping. So every once in a while, I'll go back to them, and it might be something like, should Christians vote for pro-abortion people? Is it a sin? Is it just, or something like, my next article is probably going to be something about, relating to, to American voters, probably going to share it in a few days, but something like, your citizenship isn't in America, which is, pointing to that our hope, of course, for all Christians, we're not citizens of really our, earthly nations, we're citizens of heaven, and to just kind of then, from that, extrapolate from that, the idea that what does that mean then in how you vote? What does that mean then in how you react to the election when you get what you want or when you don't get what you want? So once I have these ideas kind of fleshed out in a file, I'll then just be praying about it, studying scriptures to make sure that I am, because I, as I said before, I always want to be very candid. Well, if you're going to be very candid, then you need to make sure that you're being, very correct or you get yourself in trouble. So once I have that, I will send it to my girlfriend or maybe somebody else to read over it. And then if they don't have any objections, I'll go forward with that. So that's generally, now I have a very bad habit of procrastinating. So sometimes I will wait to the very night before to finish it. But now my goal, since I write, I publish usually on Fridays, I'm trying to finish the articles by Tuesdays. That way, then I give myself 3 days to do more praying, to do more correction, to do more editing. Because editing is my weakest aspect. Because when you're always kind of rushing and procrastinating, you're trying to, you know, finish your article right before you have to publish it, you're going to miss some things naturally. And I'm also very tired by then, because I would do an all-nighter that Thursday night. And when you're running low on sleep and you're very tired, that's not very helpful for editing properly. So that's generally my my writing process.
Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. I'll tell you, as a guy who writes to preach, I found something similar in that, you know, if I can get it done multiple days ahead, there's something about the marinating process, too, that it just kind of rattles around in your brain and your conscience and your heart. And you just start to see other stuff, you know. So when you come back to edit at a, you know, at a more, at a time closer to delivery, I think it helps you see stuff that maybe you didn't the first time you sat down to write.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. Absolutely.
You mentioned something that, again, just such a helpful segue. You mentioned about addressing an American audience. And that's something I've noticed on your blog as well. I knew you were in Canada. And I just wonder what you see when you look at, you know, I say America, the United States of America. Does United States culture look to you like a big black hole that sucks everybody's attention in? Or are when you're addressing an American, a U.S. audience, are you thinking, you know what, what's happening in the U.S. is going to touch other cultures, or, you know, we're kind of in a homogenous culture anyway, so we're going to have similar issues. How do you think through as a Canadian addressing a United States audience?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we have to go back to, you know, before I created my blog. As I said before, a lot of my friends were embracing Black Lives Matter and social justice and critical theory because of what was happening in Ferguson. So here you have this one fairly small city, relatively, and the whole world is listening. The whole world is watching. And through Ferguson, Black Lives Matter spreads all throughout America, all throughout Canada, all throughout, you know, Britain, Europe, and the whole world, to a point where even today, as many Nigerians are fighting real oppression in Nigeria, they have Black Lives Matter signs. And for them, it means something different than what it means in America. Nevertheless, that shows the influence of these you know, these movements and these ideas. So my friends are embracing it. And then you already had a Black Lives Matter chapter in Toronto as well. So if I, as a Canadian, want to address these things in concerning Canadians, I need to cut off, in my mind, the head of the dragon, which is coming from America. Because if I can reject that, everything else in Canada is simple, because everything else is little dragons, all the little heads. And that was a perspective. On top of that, American culture is highly influential in every part of the world, especially in Canada. Our media is dominated by American news. In fact, we have all your channels. We have all, like, we have Fox News here. We have CNN. We have all these things. So Canadian news is very much influenced and heavily, heavily impacted by American culture and American news, to the point where our Prime Minister Justin Trudeau just mentioned that his government, the Canadian government, is working on creating barriers that will stop potential riots and disruptions in our cities after the American election. Not the Canadian election, but the American election. Canadians, this might surprise you, Canadians are definitely more aware of American politics than we are about Canadian politics, just because of the nature of how highly influential the American market and American media is in the Canadian market and Canadian news. Also, historically, concerning Black people for a long time, because of the slave trade, have had a common interest. And that is why you also have all these different Black Lives Matter chapters, because the perception is that, you know, and this is through an ideology called Pan-Africanism, that all Black people are one and we all have common interests and common oppressions. So all these things are intertwined. And if I'm going to address it, where is the most helpful place for me to address it? You know, which would be then, again, going back to the center of the issue, which would be in America. On top of that, I primarily, I see well, the pro-life issue and all these social justice issues are all intertwined. So, and that's how a lot of people like me throughout history have always seen these things. What I mean by that is the abolitionists in America were highly dependent on the abolitionists in the UK. The abolitionists in the UK were highly dependent on what was happening in the French Revolution in France. People who are doing work in one nation are always seeking to influence other nations or also being influenced by other groups in other nations too. So the reason why I address the American issue is because going back to the original point, it is the most, I think, in my context or in with what I think is most effective, it is the best place to address these issues, because I guarantee you all Canadians or even in Africa, right? So I'll give you a very simple example as to how American politics influenced Canada and Africa or Ghana, where I was originally from. When Trump became president, he, I'm sure as you know, he got rid of the Mexico City policy in America. That has major impact in Ghana, where the abortion rate is four times higher than it is in America and Canada. The abortion rate, which is highly, highly influenced by the Mexico City policy, because one of the things that, you know, the West have wanted to do to this, you know, to harm Africans today is, well, let's, you know, in their mind, they're not, Africans are not having enough abortion, which is part of the reason why there's so much poverty in America, in Africa, in their mind. So one of the best ways to stop that for them is to kill the babies. And Obianuju Okocha has been so helpful in addressing these issues. She's a Nigerian / British pro-life activist, and she's been addressing this stuff for a long time. So that has major influence on what's happening in my original, birth country. Then in Canada, since Trump got rid of the Mexico City policy, you have our prime minister, Justin Trudeau, who then increases funding for international abortion from Canadians, where now Canada is the most reliable. Canada is giving out the most money to internationally to fund abortions than any other nation is Canada now, because of a reaction to Trump getting rid of the Mexico City policy. So all these things are intertwined. What America does affects what's happening in Canada and America. And what America isn't doing is affecting, of course, what's happening in Africa and Canada. So all these things are related, and that's why I address these issues. But also, from a more Christian point of view, the reform movement is also, again, at the center of it is Canada. I'm sorry, it's in America. We don't have, you know, of course, we have Tim Challies and many other people, but, you know, the most influential Christians are all in America for the most part. So addressing what's happening in America is more ideal, because that's where everyone is looking for influence. So not just politically, not just culturally, but also theologically or within a Christian environment. If everything is being said from America, then I need to address what's happening in America, particularly to address what's happening to Christians or amongst Christians across the world.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, as an American, member of the United States, I'm very glad you are taking that approach. We're profited by your work, and what you're saying there makes a ton of sense to me. It's actually on that Mexico City policy that you're referring to that I wanted to follow up on a piece that you wrote back in September that I thought was incredibly timely and helpful. The title was "Do Democrats Decrease Abortion Rates?" And about the time the piece came out, I just noticed this huge surge in people on social media, even people in my immediate circles, kind of talking about the idea that in some roundabout or unanticipated way, Democrats were, their policies led to lower abortion rates. And so while that rhetorical tactic is just getting thrown around and it was going unchallenged in a lot of places, I read your piece and I thought, man, you've made short work of this. And so if you'll let me, and I think our listeners will profit from that, I'm going to read a section that I think is really strong and very illuminating, and then kind of follow up with a question for you, if that's okay.
Of course, yeah.
So you wrote, "Abortion activists, naturally, are prone to lying. They lie about science, and they lie about statistics. The pro-abortion movement is actually centered on lies. One of their most powerful pioneers, Dr. Bernard Nathanson, a co-founder of the first American pro-abortion advocacy group, NARAL, and an abortionist who killed over 75,000 babies before he became pro-life, admitted the pro-abortion movement relies on lies to advance their agenda. He said, "We fed the public a line of deceit, dishonesty, a fabrication of statistics and figures. We succeeded in breaking down the laws limiting abortions because the time was right and the news media cooperated. We sensationalized the effects of illegal abortions, fabricated polls which indicated that 85% of the public favored unrestricted abortion when we knew it was only about 5%. We unashamedly lied, and yet our statements were quoted by the media as though they had been written in law." And after that quote, you pick up in the same way, abortion activists today are lying and misleading many Americans into believing Democrats decrease abortion rates. You know, I read your piece just after having a fairly heated conversation with a friend who had bought that, an evangelical friend who had bought that lie. And I said, think just about the Mexico City policy, just right there, and run this up against reality. Yeah. So, Samuel, my question to you would be, why do you think so many evangelicals were ready to countenance that lie or embrace it outright?
Yeah, that's another great question. And I think there's maybe two or three major reasons why. The first is so many influential Christians now, so many influential pastors are saying that. One of the most disappointing things that has become increasingly clear, we knew for a long time that in the reform movement, we had a problem with celebrity culture or celebrity pastors. We've known that. But I don't think we recognized how destructive it could be, because and we see that now here, where so many people, we reform people who say we're Bereans, we're now disregarding and dismissing our reformed traditions and our reformed biblical culture by now saying, well, this person said it, this leader said it, this leader is godly, and this leader cares. So they're saying this thing, which is suggesting that the Democrats reduce abortion because they say it. So many Christians now are unwilling to figure it out for themselves, to figure out what's the truth. Now, even logically, it's not true. Because why, if somebody's pro-abortion, why would they want to or why would they decrease abortion? It's not true whatsoever. Nevertheless, we reform people now, we evangelicals are so willing to just accept whatever is true, or whatever we think is true, or whatever a influential pastor is saying. We become very much like what we don't like, which is, you know, I remember, you know, so many prosperity gospel preachers would say, touch not my anointed, you know, and they would phrase what they really meant by that. Now they're taking the text out of context, but they would say, well, you can't criticize Benny Hinn because he's an anointed man. He can be wrong, essentially. And I think we've kind of embraced that kind of thinking concerning many influential and great reformed leaders. But on this issue, on some of these issues, they're wrong. So I think that's one of it. The other thing is social justice has become so prominent now in evangelical circles that many people are willing to accept anything they say. If you believe that evangelicals are prone to being complicit, as many say today, to being complicit in systemic racism, that if you believe that evangelicals are just not fighting the issue enough, if you start to believe that all we care about is the abortion issue, as if that's not, even if that's something that somebody just cares about at all, that's sufficient, but that's a whole different issue. But we've become kind of embarrassed about our evangelical positions because we think that we're not doing enough on this issue. And there's a group called the AND Campaign, and they're one of the most frustrating, you know, they're a Christian organization, but they've been very unhelpful. And the AND Campaign is essentially says that they are pro-life and pro-mother, as if there's a distinction between the two. But I mentioned them because essentially they're saying, look, you can vote for a Democrat and still be pro-life. And this has been this movement, this campaign has been, you know, getting more and more influential in Christian circles. I mentioned them because there's a perception now by many evangelicals that the Democrats have so much to offer because they are supportive of the social justice ideology that so many Christians today are embracing. Because if you believe that Black people are being oppressed, if you believe that we Christians have failed poor people, because in their mind, unless you ask the government to help the poor people or to force taxpayer money to help poor people, in their mind, they think that you're not doing enough on helping poor people. But if you embrace that thinking, then you're already vulnerable to accepting some of their other thinking as well, too, which is that the Democrats, by introducing policies in their mind, supposedly that helps poor people, that helps single mothers, that helps different vulnerable groups, they think because they do that, it inevitably leads to less abortions. Well, that is illogical because it assumes that people kill babies primarily because they don't have enough money. That's not true at all. Actually, wealthier women are more likely to get abortion than anybody else. So a lot of it comes from, I think, a commitment to accepting whatever our favorite celebrity pastors are saying, or a commitment to social justice ideology, which prioritizes so-called economical justice, so-called racial justice over the abortion issue, which then means that you then have to find, because to kind of summarize it, if you have been committed to social justice and critical theory, you've already moved ideologically toward the Democrats. And then it becomes easy to justify, for many people, the only real issue behind supporting the Democrats is the abortion issue, which then will tempt somebody to want to justify that, to want to reason out of that, to say, well, the Democrats aren't that bad on the abortion issue, which is why I'm going to vote for them. And once you already believe that, you become vulnerable to believing in lies, because you want to believe that lie, because you want to, right? And I think that's why so many evangelicals, sorry, that might be a bit, probably making it too complicated. Hopefully it was in simple terms, but that's why I believe that so many Christians are supporting the idea that Democrats are decreasing abortions.
Yeah, no, I didn't think it was too complicated. It's depressing. You know, I think you've gotten at it, and it doesn't reveal good things about a movement that has been really profitable to me and has helped me, you know. Now, you've specifically addressed this very issue within the movement of Reformed Christianity. Back in July of 2020, you wrote, "Why Reformed Christians Are Vulnerable to Social Justice." And I kind of wish that piece would get a new discovering, and that it would start getting passed around on social media again, because I think it has continuing relevance. For our listeners' sake, could you walk us through your conclusions on that question about why Reformed Christians are vulnerable in that way? And then I'd just be curious to know, 4 months later, would you adjust that piece in any way if you were writing it now? Would you add or do anything different?
Mm-hmm. Wow, has it really been 4 months since July? Man, this 2020 has been such a crazy year that I don't even know what month we're in or how long it's been since July. Yeah. So one of the things I mentioned in the or some of the conclusions I come up with is that goes back to that celebrity kind of culture again, where many Reformed people started to pursue, even if unintentionally, a lot of the reasons why you had the New Covenantist movement. The New Covenantism movement was, I don't want to say created, but it was established as a response to the seeker-sensitive movement. Unfortunately, what had ended up happening is the Reform movement themselves became, or the New Covenantist movement, the Young Restless Reform movement, also then started to borrow the same kind of tactics, the same kind of strategy, creating big networks and wanting to gain big numbers and wanting to attract young people particularly. And that inevitably then led to an attraction, or wanting to attract not just young people, want to attract the right kind of people, which culturally became Black people. And since now, if you want to attract a certain group, well, especially Black people, well, how do you get their attention? How do you keep them in their churches? Well, then it's oftentimes like the seeker sensitive movement. It's by saying the same things they're saying. It's by believing the same things they believe. And then you lose biblical theology. So that's one of the examples, and which is also tied to the fact that you had a huge number of Black people across both Canada, America, UK, everywhere. Black people who historically have not been Reformed, but we became Reformed through Christian hip hop and through Paul Washer and Piper and MacArthur and all these guys. And we started going to these, we started going to Reformed churches. And I think that's where there was a huge disconnect, because for a long time, we were united over Calvinism and the five solas, but we never addressed how to understand a biblical worldview. That's because for a long time, in some cases intentionally, in some cases not, the new reform movement wanted to overcorrect the fundamentalist. We didn't want to be too political. And there is some value in that, right? We don't want to forget that we are first ambassadors of Christ, and we're more than just activists for a cause. We're ambassadors of Christ, right? And the fundamentalists, they went too far, and sometimes they would forget to preach the gospel as you're preaching about basically Republican positions. So wanting to correct that ended up becoming, they ended up going too far, where they didn't address politics or a biblical worldview at all, which is a big problem, because when you have all these black people coming in who've been historically liberal, who've been historically, leftist, voting Democrat, thinking the world outside of Reformed theology different than many of their white brothers do, when Black Lives Matter emerges, when Michael Brown gets killed, and all of a sudden they're saying or thinking differently than their pastors, they think, oh, wait a minute, my pastor's a racist. And believe me, many of my friends in the U.S. were saying that. They thought, I never knew my pastor was a racist. All this time, I've been going to his home, I've been talking with him, and I had no idea that he thought my life didn't matter. Why? Because the pastor did not agree with that black Christian concerning Black Lives Matter, which then leads to a disconnect. But now you have a choice as a pastor. Do you teach the truth and risk losing your church members, or do you stay quiet? Well, many people chose to stay quiet, which then led to many of their members becoming more and more committed, in some cases more radical in this issue. Well, then when it's gone to that point, when you stay quiet for a long time, inevitably you will start to say what you want. You start to say what everybody else is saying. And that's one of the reasons why I think so many Christians, so many Reformed Christians have become vulnerable to that. But over the last 4 months, one of the things that's become also pretty obvious is, and I didn't address in the article, I think I wanted to, but I thought maybe that the article was already too long. But we Reformed Christians, and it's been said many times too, that, we have a history of many of our Reformed heroes saying some racist things or owning slaves. So Whitfield, whom I love, said some things that were sympathetic to white supremacy. I trust that he repented from that, but nevertheless, these are things that he said. And he owned slaves. Whitfield didn't say anything that was white supremacist, but he said, Edwards. Edwards didn't say anything that was white supremacist, but he did own slaves. And there were some Puritans who also owned slaves as well. And that's been an issue for a lot of Black Christians for a while. And that's something that's been said to white people, that, hey, or to white Reformed people, that your heroes were racist or slave owners. And there's been this bitterness from many Black people over that history, and an embarrassment of white people because of that history. And many of them have wanted to correct that, which again has led to an overcorrection, where now, because so many Reformed thinkers, so many Reformed leaders didn't speak out against racist slavery and segregation in American history, so many pastors today think that if they don't join this Black Lives Matter social justice movement, they think they'll be remembered just like Whitfield and Edwards today are being remembered. And I think that's one of the issues. More than that, on a more theological level, I think it's become very obvious that we Reformed people, or particularly we Calvinist people, have a very shallow view of Calvinism. Especially, I don't think we quite understand what total depravity means. Some influential pastors have said that we Calvinists should especially believe in systemic racism, because we believe in total depravity. We believe that all humanity is totally depraved. We believe that in our depravity, all of us are corrupt. Therefore, That means that every system is corrupt. And then here's the big part. Therefore, every system is sinful against Black people and systemically racist against Black people. That is very enticing and very appealing to so many reform people because it seems to make sense. Except that's not how we should understand total depravity at all. Because total depravity means that you and us, well, anybody before Christ, anybody before salvation, is totally and completely unable to do good, or is consistently, as Genesis 6:5 says, consistently thinking evil. We are evil. Even in our good works, we are evil. And especially, we cannot choose Christ unless he chooses us first. It does not mean we are corrupt in the sense, we are, of course we are corrupt, but not in the sense that we are as bad as we can be, or that we are as depraved as we can be. Nor does it mean that every action that we do is necessarily sinful. We may have sinful intentions, but not every act is sinful. And especially it doesn't mean that every policy is sinful or depraved, right? Because if that's the case, and we have to believe then that if we overturn Roe v. Wade, that itself is corrupt. And especially going back to that argument, if we believe that because of total depravity, if we believe that every system is systemically racist against Black people, then we also have to believe that every system is systemically racist against white people, brown people, and or that every system oppresses everyone. And if that's the case, then how can we say that a system is partial or discriminatory against one group of people? It makes no sense. But the point is, because so many of us have a very shallow and unhelpful understanding of total depravity, we are misunderstanding how to apply that concerning these issues. And, those reasons would be why I think many of us, many reform people, have embraced, or have become vulnerable to social justice.
Mm. Well, thank you for that answer. And there's a lot there that even as someone who thought, I'm with you. I had suspected that sort of the Young, Restless, and Reform group had picked up the pragmatism of the attractional church model, the church growth model. You've added a lot to my understanding there, and I trust our listeners as well. You know, you raised the issue of our heroes and their failures. I also think that, the faith has heroes to aspire to be like. And so you recently wrote this piece about how the Christian abolitionist movement, say William Wilberforce, is comparable to today's anti-abortion effort, but they are catching modern anti-abortion workers are catching flack in a way that, if it had been followed, would have been a real hindrance to Wilberforce as well. And listener, if you haven't read that piece, just hit pause, pull it up on your phone and read it right now. It's great. It's excellent. It's wonderful. But in that piece, Samuel, you say that making abortion illegal is a sacred duty, and using some of the language of the abolitionists there in Britain. I'm with you, but I'd just like to play it out. How did you come to that conclusion? And then what do you say to the evangelical who says single issue voting on abortion ends up leading to neglecting to care for the whole person?
Sorry, repeat the last part again, please.
Yeah. So there's this new criticism that has emerged that, you don't want to be a single issue voter on abortion, because if you're just a single issue abortion voter, then you're going to neglect caring for the whole person. It kind of harkens back to some of the stuff you said earlier, I suspect, about, you lack compassion for the whole human. And I'm just curious what you would say back to that.
Yeah. So concerning why I say that the pro-life movement or being the anti-abortion movement is a sacred duty for the Christian is because I always quote this. It's one of my favorite quotes in the Bible. It's very simple, and I like simple verses. But it says, hate evil or abhor what is evil, love good, establish justice. One of the ironies of the social justice movement is it's actually discouraging Christians to fight against injustice because the social justice movement is actually pro-injustice because they are fighting for things that the Bible does not call them to fight. They're actually fighting for things that the Bible which tells them not to fight, which is, of course, by promoting these critical theory and all this, essentially creating or fighting for movements that teach people to disobey what God says about not favoring others. They're encouraging people to fight or to push for policies that will create more division and more discrimination against people that they consider privileged. Nevertheless, God calls us to fight for justice, which means fighting against social justice. And people forget this. Social justice, I think I mentioned this in one of the articles that you referenced, but the very foundational element of social justice is abortion. That is the biggest thing. Planned Parenthood refer to themselves as a social justice organization. The Democrats, who are radical in abortion, also say they are a social justice political platform. We Christians are called to fight against injustice, and we're called to establish justice, especially for the weak and vulnerable. Who's more weak and vulnerable than preborn babies today? More than that, the book of Proverbs, I think it's chapter 24, says that I'll read it. Rescue those who are being taken away to death. Hold back those who are stumbling to the slaughter. Then it says, if you say, behold, we did not know this, does not he who weighs the heart perceive it? Does not he who keeps watch over your soul know it? And will he not repay man according to his work? Again, it says, rescue those who are being taken away to death. Hold back those who are stumbling to the slaughter. Babies are being taken away to death every day. Thousands in America, hundreds in Canada. They're being taken to the slaughter, and it is a slaughter. I've seen horrible videos that I don't want to see, but I have to see so that I will continue to be motivated about what's happening. I've seen pictures of babies who are slaughtered. God has called us to a sacred duty to be just and to establish justice in our society, especially for the weak and vulnerable. The abolitionists like Wilberforce, they did that in their time concerning slavery. Well, slavery, racist slavery, right? That was evil. It's horrible. And yet, the slaves were not as weak and as vulnerable as preborn babies. So that is why it's a sacred duty. That is why it disturbs me to no end when Christians today suggest it's okay to vote for slaughterers. It's okay not to rescue those who have been taken away to slaughter, but it's actually okay to vote for people who will actually do that. It's insanity. Mm. Now, concerning, I think you mentioned the argument about, you know, the whole and being wholly pro-life and everything. I'm trying hard not to be too harsh, but yeah, I don't know how else to say it except to say that is a lie from the devil. It's a lie. I don't know how else to say it. It's a lie. It's a lie. It's a lie that was taken, that's borrowed from pro-abortionists, actually. The abortionists were the ones that came up with being wholly pro-life as a way to dismiss the pro-life movement. Because they knew by using our rhetoric, our language, our ideas against us in that matter, that it would deceive many people, many pro-life people, generally pro-life people, into thinking, oh, you know what? There are two different kinds of pro-life or the pro-life movement. Or they might say, well, you know what? Being anti-abortion is just one way to be pro-life. But if you are pro-legal immigration, if you are pro-socialism, if you are pro all these other things, well, that has a much bigger impact. You know, that's actually more than just one issue. That's several issues. That's more important than the abortion issue. It's not from God. It's not from Christ. It's not from the Bible. It's completely, the Bible does not command us to establish socialism. Actually, it tells us not to steal, right? So, it's not from God. More than that, I've asked people this before, and I think I also mentioned in your article. Would we say the same thing if abortion was, you know, was say if, you know, abortion and infanticide was legal up to say 5 years old for a baby? So if it was legal for a 5 year old and or 4 year old, 3 year old, 2 year old, 1 year old, if it was legal for them to be murdered, would we say the same thing? Would we say it's okay to vote for someone like that because of illegal immigration, because we support that and, you know, socialism and all that kind of stuff? I imagine we wouldn't. Although these days, I guess, who knows, right? But for the most part, I imagine we would say no, that's going too far. Well, why? what's the difference between a preborn baby and a five-year-old? Are they not just as human? So that reveals our apathy and in some ways how we devalue the humanity of the preborn baby, that we think they are less human, less important than five-year-olds or 20-year-olds. And more than that, it's not legal to kill poor people. It's not legal to kill immigrants. It's not legal to kill anyone than the preborn baby. And if, as has been said many times before, but if a politician says they want to murder preborn babies, now they won't say it that way. Of course they won't. But Satan never says the full truth either. If they say, well, I want to give women the right to kill a baby at any point during the pregnancy or even after the pregnancy if the baby survives the abortion. If they say that, but yet they say, well, yeah, but I also want to help out poor children. How can you believe them? Because if they want to murder vulnerable babies, why would they truly want to help vulnerable babies? It makes no sense. Why would you want to give somebody more power to help, quote unquote, poor people, poor children, when they're saying it's okay to kill those poor children when they're in the womb? We've become so gullible. We're so deceived. So deceived. And the thing is, God does not call us to end poverty. That's actually an unrighteous desire. Now, let me phrase that. Not so much a desire, but a commitment. Because God himself, Christ himself said, the poor you will always have with you. We can help them, but we cannot end poverty. That's Christ's job when he returns, not our job. Our job is to, through the church, not by trying to petition a government, but by we, the church, going out to help poor people. But we cannot end it. By trying to end it, we are fighting against God's order. We're fighting against God himself. Because we cannot end it. The sinful world, it's impossible. Again, we should absolutely help them out. God has called the church to stand up and to help poor people. Now, that's the church, not the government. We honestly get lazy and we want the government to do our job for us. God has called us, the church, the local church, to go out to our community and to serve and help poor people. Ending poverty isn't in that mandate. God will do that when he comes back and he creates the new earth and the new heaven. Nevertheless, again, it's not legal to kill poor people, but it's legal to kill preborn babies. When we start to say a so-called more holistic approach to the pro-life movement or a more consistent approach to the pro-life movement is ridiculous. When we say that, it's that ending poverty is just as pro-life as saving preborn babies. That's a huge concern because that shows we have bad theology and therefore a very bad understanding of justice. Especially, by the way, it's not justice to go out there to help poor people. It's kindness. It's what we're called to. It's righteousness. It's justice before God, theologically. But law, by the law, it is not justice. It is kindness, which then, of course, is that if you are a just person, you do kindness. But justice is when you are actually committing a crime against another person. And then, well, not, it's not justice by means. It's an injustice to commit a crime against another person. But if you are not able to help a poor person, that's not an injustice at all. That just means that you're not able to be kind in that situation. So we can't mix the two. We've mixed the two now. We've mixed kindness with justice, and it's been destructive. And if we think that a so-called more consistent approach to the pro-life movement or a more holistic approach to the pro-life movement involves socialism, essentially, or ending poverty and all that stuff, then that means the Mosaic Law itself isn't pro-life, which is a major problem, of course, because the Mosaic Law does not petition the government to create a welfare system. It does not tell the government to do all the things right now that the social justice movement want to accomplish.
Brother, that is so well said, and I appreciate what you write. I appreciate what you say. I appreciate your work. You have been incredibly generous with your time here. We are so thankful for how generous you've been. I'm going to put links to your blog, all your social media in the show notes. So listener, make sure you're checking all those things when you're done listening. But if we could maybe end on one question that's a little bit more lighthearted than the weighty subject matter we've been talking about. so far, you have a very visually compelling Instagram account, and there's this excellent wedding of good quotes with powerful imagery. And so I'm just curious, do you do your own graphic design too? And how do you work through that with which quote to stick with what image?
I wish I could say I do it all, but no. Some of my friends oftentimes joke by telling me which at least in the beginning, when I started my Instagram page, which posts come from me or which posts are not from me. Because when I try to do it, it's a mess. I am not good at whatsoever. I can just write and that's it. I said to you earlier that my girlfriend has been so helpful to me on my, writing and everything else and social media. And that's the Instagram. I oftentimes joke saying that she controls my Instagram page. It's not mine. It's hers. It's mine in that, I oftentimes will reply to people on message, through messages, or all the words are mine, but the images, the graphics, all that stuff, that's not from me whatsoever. I don't have a single talent to be able to do that, but she's incredibly talented and very helpful and very skilled. And, so all those images are coming from her. She's incredible. She uses a Canvas, I think, just some app on the iPhone or any phone today. And she just creates all these incredible graphics, and I don't know how she does it. And she makes my words look a lot better than they really are through all those graphics. So that's all from her.
Yeah, you're being well served, sir. I'm glad to hear that. And thanks to her as well, because she is doing a good job helping get your words out. Look, brother, thank you so much again for coming on. This has been a treat, and we're just really thankful. And I would encourage you, just keep up the good work, brother. We need your voice, and I just hope you keep giving us access to these words you write.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed this, and whenever you want to have me back, so let me know, and I'll be happy to come back.
Oh, we will definitely take you up on that. Okay. Well, thank you, brother.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. It was wonderful talking to Samuel, and I am thankful for how generous he was with his time in this conversation. Be sure and check the show notes for links to his social media accounts, and also make it a point to visit slowtowrite.com to read the excellent work Samuel is putting out. Thank you for listening to this episode of the CRV Podcast. If you have enjoyed our podcast, we would appreciate you taking a moment to leave us a review on your favorite podcasting platform, as well as telling a friend about the show. Thanks again for listening. For all the folks at CRV, this is Jeff Wright, wishing you all the best in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ.